This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. If Henri Behar does his job right, you are barely aware of what he's accomplished. He's a film subtitler and specializes in English to French and French to English translations. He's worked on more than 100 films, taking the content and subtleties of language and making them understandable to a foreign audience. He's done the French subtitles for well-known English-speaking films, including Zelig, Married to the Mob, Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, Shakespeare in Love, and Summer of Sam. Behar says to subtitle a movie, he has to follow the rhythm and the pacing of the dialogue.
The basics of subtitling are sort of simple.
Mm-hmm.
A subtitle line cannot start before the dialogue line is spoken. It has to start at the same time. And it has to be perceived, key word here, perceived, as ending when the dialogue line is no longer spoken. So that gives you a certain number of feet and frame. That number of feet and frames gives you, by a simple calculation, gives you the number of characters that you're entitled to.
Right.
So if the line is, I woke up this morning and had a cup of tea, that lasted, I don't know, about a second and a half. That would give me, 17, that would give me something like 23 characters.
So that's...
To translate that.
That's pretty easy, right?
Yes, but if you say, got up this morning, had a cup of tea... Well, that's, half a second. What do you do?
And that's the challenge of obviously.
And that's the challenge of subtitling. Right. Yes, you have to make do.
But you
so
also
the two notions here in this line are morning and tea. And if you have to sacrifice one, it depends on the context. Either you sacrifice tea, or you sacrifice morning.
But for the audience, you want them to just dip down, look at the lines, and then get back to the visuals, or get back to what's happening on the screen.
Oh yes.
Is the goal, then, of a subtitler in part really to capture that rhythm of dialogue over the sort of word-by-word translation that would give an audience, a viewer, a sense of what each of those words were, but you may miss something that's essential to that rhythm of speech?
If you want to be that specific, yes. I think you should... The job of the subtitler is to retain as much as possible of the flavor of the character that's speaking. Even if you have to twist the literal translation into something that would not be acceptable academically, but would be acceptable dramatically, so if it's as if you were translating a play,
right?
The beat is different. Now, I have one theory, but this is just me, and I know that I try every time to do that whenever it's possible. I have a feeling that if you're watching a movie, and you have a dialogue that goes beat, 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 and the subtitle goes melody, 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 as a viewer, you just go, something's wrong, something's not working. So if possible, if there are three breaks in a dialogue line, I try to have three breaks in the subtitle. You won't notice, but you will feel comfortable with it.
So you kind of have to have the word sort of syllable by syllable in a way, sort of match the rhythm of the dialogue.
I kind of like the two to dance together.
Yeah. Well, I always feel when I'm watching a film and you do see a dialogue that goes on, and then you glance down at the subtitles and you see a rather short subtitle, that you figure you've got to be missing something. You think that's true?
I don't think it happens with the French, in all honesty.
Really?
Because French is generally longer than English. So if you do English into French, you have... you don't have that. If you do French into English, sometimes you might have that feeling. Then you work it. You work it through.
When...
The worst might be, actually, when you get a Japanese film or something like that, and they go on and go, they do this whole two-second line, dialogue line, and the subtitle goes, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you know that you're losing something.
Mm-hmm. When you're working on a film, do you consult with the screenwriter, the director, to just make sure that you're on the same wavelength as them?
As much as possible, yes. Mm-hmm. It depends on them. I always insisted to, if possible, to be in touch with either the writer or the director. So that after I've done most of the translation, if I have a problem, I can call them and say, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
Or this occupied too much space. I had to take an option. And this is what I took. For instance, when I did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I didn't have space, for instance, at the beginning in Reel One, I didn't have space in the subtitle on screen to put gigantic bats. It's either gigantic or bats. So I went for bats because we needed bats for the rest of the dialogue. But I did run it past Terry Gilliam, and I said, I'm sorry, I don't have gigantic bats. I know it's a great beat in English, but mm-hmm. I don't have the space. Do you agree on that? And he says, yeah.
That was okay.
Yeah.
I
remember another time I was doing a film. I think it was Drugstore Cowboy. And I'm afraid whoever had transcribed Drugstore Cowboy, A, must have been slightly tone deaf, and B, was sort of rather puritanical. So every time, I don't know if you can say these words on radio, every time you had you mother whatever or F this, F that, she or he would write inaudible, unintelligible. So with that kind of a film, it's a bit of a problem.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Henri Behar, and he's a subtitler talking to us about the various movies he has subtitled. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Henri Behar, and we're talking about his work as a subtitler. He also writes about cinema for French Vogue. Looking at the list of films that you've done, including Menace to Society, Boys in the Hood, Son of Sam, and many others as well, do you find that swear words, the F word, all those words we're familiar with, do they translate well from English into French, or does it lose something?
Again, it comes down to a question of beat. Don't forget that it's not just what you read. You also see a film, you see characters move, and you hear the word, the F word, and all its combinations. So ultimately, at some point, as a translator, you just ignore them. You know that the F word is going to come back every 10 syllables. But then you work your subtitle in such a way that you have the same beat. Again, it's a question of beat.
But do audiences...
Do I make sense?
Yeah, but do audiences in France, they know what the F word is, I would assume.
I beg your pardon. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Is there any place in the world where they don't know the F word?
I was just checking on that, right.
Please. No, there are things, for instance, again, sometimes I myself don't know what's being said in a film.
Right.
I remember Goodwill Hunting at one point. I was reading the text, and Matt Damon at one point says to a sort of an Ivy League kind of guy, do you like apples? And the guy says, yes. Matt Damon slams a phone number, Mini Driver's phone number, on the window of the cafe and goes, she gave me her phone number, so how do you like them apples? And I was going, what the hell? Why the hell are they talking of apples? I did not know what, how do you like them apples?
As an American
as
slang
an American
phrase.
Slang phrase.
So
well,
so
I learned.
Well, so how, I mean, give us the French then for how do you like them apples?
Well, have you seen the film?
I have.
Okay, so I had to play with the context. I had to play with the context of the film. So I translated I forgot about apples and any comparison with fruit. I just went, are you pleased with yourself? Are you happy with yourself? And the guy says, yes. She gave me her phone number. Now, how are you still pleased with yourself? That was the way I twisted it. So how do you feel now?
Right, which essentially gets to that the essence of that interchange there.
Correct.
Yeah. Do you work alone? And by that, I mean, if you're working on a particular scene, do you have someone that you call up and test a subtitle with? Or do you test subtitles on audiences to make sure it works for them?
A scene per se, no. A movie, yes. Particularly when it comes to slang. Because slang changes so fast. Hispanic slang, American slang, American black slang. If you deal with a Canadian film, you have Canadian Haitian kind of slang or Jamaican slang. Sometimes I don't quite know how to go about it. But then I get the gist. Again, I call the writer and say, excuse me, what does mm-hmm. that mean in Jamaican? And how can I translate it? And then once that is done, yes, I do have a certain number of people that I know who live in that kind of milieu. When I dealt with Menace to Society, I called a friend of mine who lives that kind of life in one of the suburbs of Paris. And I said, okay, so how do you say this uh-huh. week? Because it changes every week. And he said, oh, yeah, well, so what did you write? And I said, they said, oh, psh, please.
So he would say, no, right?
No. Yeah, I was thinking like, please, you're so square, it's a joke. So I said, okay, so tell me. And once you get into that, and it's amazing because throughout the world, as far as I could tell, in the languages that I speak, all the kids who also live a violent kind of life, all those who are interested in hip-hop culture in all its forms, have the same thing. They are incredibly attracted and adept and deft and agile in imagery, in visual acrobatics, in verbal acrobatics. So when you yourself like this kind of thing, otherwise you would never have studied several languages, mm-hmm. It becomes fun. And the generation gap sort of disappears for a short while.
I want to thank you very much, Henri Behar, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Henri Behar has subtitled more than 100 films, including most recently Shakespeare in Love and Summer of Sam. I find I can't go to a movie theater and not buy popcorn. The aroma is so seductive and the habit is too ingrained. Popcorn and movies just seem to go together, but how did that come about? My guest Andrew Smith traces the history of popcorn in the United States in his new book, Popped Culture. Smith teaches culinary history at the New School University in New York. He's the author of many books, including three on the tomato. Smith says the common myth has been that the Indians served popcorn to the pilgrims at the first Thanksgiving. He found no proof of this and believes American traders brought popcorn back to New England from South America.
The first real evidence that I have for popcorn in America is not until the 1810s, 1820s. And it's simply there, a mention of it in sales and seeds catalogs and that sort of thing. But by the 1840s, all of a sudden, everybody is talking about this new, exciting addition to American cookery, popcorn. And so you have literary corn and people like Emerson and people like Thoreau writing letters in their to friends and writing notes in their diaries saying, oh, I popped some corn last night. It was really exciting stuff. That's a slight transliteration of it.
Yeah. There's actually a recipe from the late 1840s, which sounds just about the way one would make popcorn at home. Take a gill or half pint or more of Valparaiso or popcorn, put in a frying pan, slightly buttered or rubbed with lard, hold the pan over fire so as constantly to stir or shake the corn within, and in a few minutes each kernel will pop and turn inside out. Doesn't sound like too much has changed.
That's the first recipe that I found, and you're quite right. In many ways, the popping of the corn has not changed at all. But shortly after that, you have a lot of recipes that came into popcorn cookery, so that the number one way to consume popcorn wasn't the way we consume it today, which is out of a box or out of a bag or out of a bowl, but literally as a cereal. It was America's first cereal. It predates Kellogg's Corn Flakes and things of that sort. But the problem is it got soggy as soon as you put it in milk. It clogged up. So you could have to really consume it fast in a matter of a couple of minutes before it became very soggy. So it was not an ideal cereal food. But it continued to be eaten as a cereal up until the 1930s.
It's interesting to read about all the various popcorn poppers that have been made since the 19th century, trying to figure out how to pop the corn, but also, of course, contain it so that it's not lying all over the floor. And the one I really loved was in Good Housekeeping, about a woman who reported that she took the globe off her burner lamp and put the kernels inside the lamp, and she said it was very successful.
Well,
to believe.
All the early evidence is that people had a kernel or they had a cob, and they put the cob by a fire, and when it got hot enough, it popped, and some of the pop kernels would go into the flames, and some of it would go onto the ground, and then the evidence is that the kids in particular, but adults I'm sure as well, went around and picked up the popcorn from the ground and ate it, and they were so pleased because the ground was clean. So it was a different way of doing it. So the first really important technological invention was the wire over the fire popper, mm-hmm. which was simply a coffee roaster that you could pop corn on, it was a major reason on why popcorn expansion occurred so quickly in the 1830s and 1840s, because you could contain it, you can control it, you could take it off the fire. It was a relatively simple sort of thing to do.
It sounds like as popcorn was growing in popularity, there was this whole debate about whether it was a cereal food, whether it was a snack food, whether it was a vegetable. Help us understand the various camps and how they kind of fought about popcorn's place in eating culture.
Well, you've got to understand, in the 19th century, there was no such thing as a snack food, or certainly not the way we think of snack foods today. Almost all the snack foods that we consume today are commercial creations of the last 100 years. I mean, candy bars, popsicles, ice cream bars. I mean, all the things that you think of as snack foods are creations and inventions of the last 100 years or so. Mm-hmm. So popcorn came along with peanuts, and they introduced a whole new eating sensation. You would not just eat at a meal, you would eat between meals, which was something even my grandmother told me I couldn't do because it would destroy my appetite for food. It never did that, but in any case, there was this feeling that eating between meals there was something wrong with it. Snack foods were not something that were particularly common. When peanuts and popcorn came along, they became associated with fun times. They were associated with fairs. They were associated with later on sporting events. They were associated with circuses. And so you'd have a fun time, and in the middle of having a fun time, then you would snack on something, and that would be the popcorn and the peanuts. So you had that as something that was outside of mainstream cookery, and that was going on in one direction. Then you had people who didn't have a lot of money and needed low-cost foods, and popcorn was one of those foods which was almost no cost and could be used in such a variety of ways for cookery. So it's a health food, and it's an important way that you can consume these whole grains.
I'm speaking with Andrew Smith, and we're talking about his new book. It's called Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andrew Smith, and he's got a new book. It's called Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. Well, I'm interested in talking about how popcorn got married with the movies, but it looks as if we have to begin with vaudeville, that's really the first time you see popcorn showing up at a place of public entertainment.
Snack foods were served in vaudeville, and popcorn was the single snack food that was the most profitable. I mean, it costs almost nothing, the kernels themselves, and so the real cost of popcorn was the packaging that you had to hold it in, and it was very closely associated with vaudeville, but vaudeville was often rancorous, and in the middle of performances, you'd have people throwing popcorn around and bags around, and they would, when they finished their eating it, they'd throw the bag on the floor, and so the bags then had to be cleaned up, and it was an absolute mess. So when movie theaters came along, and because they were originally silent films that required people who were literate in order to be able to read the screens, they catered to a much higher clientele, and they didn't want to have any association with vaudeville and all of the horrible experiences that people had with the trash all over the place. So they considered all snack foods, but particularly popcorn, beneath them. So none of the early movie theaters, in fact, sold popcorn or sold other snack foods.
So what made theater owners change their mind and decide that it would be okay to serve popcorn?
Well, there were several things. The first was the invention of talking films. In the 1928-1929, you had talkies coming in, and at this point it meant that people who couldn't read, people who were literate, could in fact go to a movie and enjoy it and not have to miss part of what was going on because they couldn't read the screen. So you had a different class of people going into talking films than you had going into silent films. And as soon as the class level dropped, that was a factor. The main one, however, was the Depression. As we can all remember from our history, the Depression literally destroyed many businesses in America, and theaters were no exceptions to it. So you had a real problem. Theaters had a choice of closing their doors or figuring out other ways of making money. And it was snack foods that obviously came to their rescue, and the popcorn by far was the greatest profit margin was made on popcorn, and still is still true today. So you had a profit margin of 90-95% on popcorn sales, and you had a large number of movie theaters that would have gone under, that could not have made it on admissions alone, that really survived because of sale of snack foods, in particular popcorn.
So after the Depression and then after World War II, the habit had been made, the idea of popcorn in movies.
Well, it was not just a habit, it was a financial arrangement. Right. And that financial arrangement that began in the 30s continues today. Most movie theaters make more money on their snack food concessions than they do on admissions. So, and at some points it's been like 60% of the profit of theaters, in fact, is generated by snack foods. So it's a financial consideration to begin with. But even some theaters, for instance, in New York, refused to sell popcorn well until the late 1940s and early 1950s. And one, Lowe's Theaters, for instance, had the sign saying, check your popcorn at the door when you come in if you bring it in. So there was genuinely an anti-popcorn feeling in theaters well until the early 1950s.
Well, I'm sure if there's a dark chapter in the history of popcorn, it has to do with a report which came out a number of years ago by the Center for Science in the Public Interest, not necessarily condemning popcorn at movie theaters, but condemning the fat content in movie theater popcorn. Tell us what happened.
Well, I think it started with the popcorn industry itself. Almost from the beginning, they sold popcorn as a healthy food. And indeed, popcorn without any additive is indeed healthy. It's plenty of vitamins, it's got roughage in it, and it doesn't have many calories. And so, therefore, the popcorn industry came along and said, this is a healthy product and you should eat it if you're on a diet. And they had the popcorn diet, and they had all sorts of other people coming along and recommending this wonderful, healthful food. So you first had this image that it was something healthful. And I went to movie theaters and bought popcorn because I figured, well, I like candy, you know, and I like popcorn too, but I figured the popcorn had less calories in it, and a little salt is not going to bother anybody, and a little imitation butter is not going to bother anybody. So I think I, like many other people, were absolutely dumbfounded to find out the fat content of movie theater popcorn. And the Center for Science in the Public Interest report came along and said it was first the popping oil, which was a coconut oil that was a real problem, and that if you bought the big tub of popcorn It was had the equivalent amount of fat as 6 Big Macs. And if you added imitation butter, it was equivalent of 8 Big Macs in terms of fat. So I think that shocked all of us when it first came out. And because we thought popcorn was supposed to be so healthy, and then all of a sudden we found out that the popcorn that we like to eat was not as healthy as we had been led to believe. And the popcorn industry suffered severely because of that report.
Did they have they've changed, though, the oil, haven't they, at movie theaters? So they're not using this high fat content oil?
They shifted to canola oil, and about a month after they made the shift to canola oil, they found out that canola oil, when heated, turns to trans fatty acid, and was just as bad as the original coconut oil. As some movie theaters shifted to vegetable oil, but part of the problem is you can't get a high enough heat that pops the kernels the way most people like it. So believe it or not, many theaters are still using popcorn popped in coconut oil today. And I think the last estimate was something like 60 to 70% of theaters use coconut oil.
Well, I thank you, Andrew Smith, very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Andrew Smith is the author of Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America.